supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Test out that theory. I'm Tanya English, WHYY News.
And Tanya's story is part of a project on health in the States, a partnership of WHYY, NPR, and Kaiser Health News. In sports, the Flyers skate against the Columbus Blue Jackets tonight at the Center, action beginning at 7. And this reminder, we get an extra hour of sleep tonight. Clocks roll back 1 hour at 2 tomorrow morning as we resume standard time. You're listening to WHYY.
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we have what I think is an especially interesting question of the week coming up later in the show. Every once in a while, people ask me, can I eat this? Can I eat that? Can I eat this thing I see hanging off a tree? And this week, I decided to answer the question about dogwood fruits. They're so attractive and they're so abundant. Are they edible by humans? We'll have the surprising answer when we get to the question of the week. We'll also be discussing energy-wise landscaping, how you can reduce your energy costs by putting the right plants in the right place. And that's a lot to get done, so we better hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Tim, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thanks a lot. Thanks for taking my call.
Well,
how are you?
Thank you for making it, Tim. Where are you, sir?
I'm in South Philly, actually.
Okay, very good. The gardening capital of the world.
Sure. Well, my question is, I don't have a lot of space outside. I don't have an in-ground garden. I have a lot of stuff in pots. I've tried to go organic the best I can, and I worry that they may be fragile and may struggle through the winter. And I'm trying to think of ways to get them through the winter and into the springtime.
Now, you're in the heat sink of the city, so you have a little bit of an advantage here. Now, okay. South Philly is typically row homes. There's, like, a lot of decks. Where are your pots? Are they at ground level? Are they up in the air?
Right now, they're on a table in on my patio on ground level. I have an idea. I would like to put them on my roof, which is, you know, black tar roof, and insulate them with clear plastic and surround them with black bags of composting leaves.
I think your plants would stand a better chance of survival if you threw them out in the middle of the street for the winter.
Okay.
Now, what do we have in these pots that we're trying to overwinter?
I have some vegetables. I have some tomatoes and cucumbers.
Okay, well, they're done for the season. They don't come back. They are annuals.
Okay, that's good to know. Otherwise, I have blueberries, blackberries, raspberries.
Okay, you have...
figs,
wait a minute. You have blackberries and raspberries in containers? Okay. You really are freehanding all this stuff, aren't you, Tim?
Yeah. This is my first time trying this sort of thing.
The blackberries and raspberries are what are called cane fruits. Unlike the blueberry, which until you kill it will be a single shrub that will stay in a shrub-like form, the blackberries and raspberries have to roam around. They send up new canes in the spring. And they do especially poorly in containers. So any of your annuals, like your tomatoes and your cucumbers, they're done for the season. You compost the bodies.
Okay.
Your cane fruit should really be taken out of their containers. And do you have a friend's house where you can install a little berry patch or something like that?
I can try something. There's some green space that I might be able to take over, see what happens.
Because they're not going to be happy, and you're not going to be happy, even if they survive the winter. They need room to spread around, and they will spread quite a bit. They blackberries especially can be very invasive.
Okay.
Much better, you know, without thinking about the whole issue of winterizing plants, much better to grow shrubs like that blueberry in a container. Raspberries and blackberries really are in ground only, so try to find a spot for them. You got a fig tree, which is classic. and you've got a blueberry. Is that it? Are just two plants to overwinter?
Grapes and kiwis, actually.
Grapes and kiwis. You're out of your mind. You are a madman. You're probably the first human on the planet in the millennia of growing who's tried to grow a grapevine in a pot, you know? The grapevine really should go to a good home. The hardy kiwis, you can try. You can try. Do you have a side of your house where you could pile the pots up against that doesn't get direct sun?
Yeah.
Okay. Your best bet at this point, obviously empty out the annuals, the things that are one-season plants, and just keep the containers and their soil in your basement or in the shed for use again next year.
Okay.
Take the other plants and turn them on their sides. Don't prune them or do anything.
Okay.
And then you're probably going to have to invest in a leaf blower that has a reverse setting. In your case, because there might be a limited number of leaves that fall on your block and in your backyard, you might want to get a rechargeable one so that you could go out to one of the parks. And you would suck up their leaves, they would go through your machine, they would be deposited in a collection bag, and you would take them home, and you would build a leaf mound over top of the plants that you've turned on their sides against the side of your building, not facing south. And make that leaf pile really deep. And when springtime comes around, there's a very good chance, certainly, that the fig will still be alive.
Okay.
All right, Tim?
Well, that sounds good. Thanks a lot, Mike. I appreciate that.
You're a very adventurous young man. I wish you well.
Thank you.
Take care.
Take care.
1-888-346-9499. Greta, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Greta. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
I am doing very well today. Thank you, Greta. Where are you fine, may I ask?
Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Very good. I don't think we've ever had a call from Chattanooga, one of my favorite sounding cities. What can we do for Greta in Chattanooga?
Well, I have a question about my crepe myrtles. I was listening to your show a couple weeks ago and was horrified to find out that I'm not supposed to be pruning in the fall. And my mother-in-law always told me to prune the crepe myrtles every year in October. So I'm confused of what I should be doing.
I hate to contradict your mother, but but probably she pruned them then because, like a lot of people, she was just bored, didn't have anything to do, and it seemed like the right thing to do. All plants now, whether they are plants that are acclimated to the north or plants that tend to be more southern in their heritage, like your crepe myrtle, doesn't matter. All plants are trying to go dormant now. This is why deciduous trees drop their leaves. They're getting ready for full dormancy. They're sending all their life energy down to the root system and or the crown of the plant. Pruning stimulates growth. So just as they're trying to go to sleep, people who prune in the fall are slapping their plants around, insisting that they wake up. Also, Chattanooga is not immune to snow and ice, is it?
No,
absolutely not. So plants like figs and crepe myrtles typically will suffer some winter damage over a real harsh winter. And this damage will typically be confined to the topmost part of the tree. Well, if you have cut off the topmost part of the tree, then by definition, the damage is down lower. You get real cute, and the damage is down so low, it really hurts the tree.
Okay.
So you get three benefits by leaving it alone now. One, you don't stimulate that new growth that takes energy out of the root system. Two, you kind of leave up a sacrificial part of the tree that you're going to cut off in the spring anyway for winter to damage. And three, you get out of doing work, which is always one of my favorite things. Crepe myrtles should be pruned, however, and the best time to do so is when they first begin growing again in the spring. When you see that new growth first appear, that is the time to go over the tree really carefully, take off any remnants of last year's blooms, remove any portions that were winter damaged, and typically what you want to do is take off the top as much as the tree will grow in a typical year, which for a healthy crepe myrtle is generally around 2 feet.
Yeah.
So if you keep taking the top 2-3 feet off every spring, it actually encourages a bigger flush of blooms than not pruning or pruning in the fall. And it also helps keep those flowers down where you can see them best. So really, every spring after you're done pruning, you should have the same size tree over and over again. And because the tree is now actively growing, it's sending all that energy up from the root system, it can recover from your pruning cuts just like magically. It actually makes this type of tree especially feel better. It's like a good haircut. It starts strutting down the street showing itself off.
Well, I can't wait to see what it looks like then.
If you've had even a good success so far, you will have better success by leaving it alone in the fall and pruning it in the spring. Absolutely guaranteed.
Okay.
There's a lot of misinformation and a lot of bad advice out there specifically about crepe myrtles. You know, I made the mistake early on when this show first went on the air because I was reading in a book that you could cut them back to the ground. And then a bunch of Southern Extension agents really slapped me around and explained that over the years, just because you can do something doesn't mean you should. And you get a much more beautiful specimen, a tree that fits in the landscape better, if you just keep taking a couple feet off the top every spring.
Okay, that's even less work than...
Exactly. And that's what we're looking for in this show, Greta, less work.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, my pleasure. You take care.
You too.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that the safe time to plant spring bulbs is finally here. Yes, from now through Thanksgiving is the perfect time for gardeners in the vast majority of American climes to get their bulbs in the ground for bloom next spring. And don't forget to clean up afterwards and put something repellent on beds containing tulips and other tasty treats, unless your goal was to feed evil squirrels. But don't you go covertly camouflaging your crocus condos just yet, because we'll be right back with Energy Wise Landscaping, the answer on the edibility of dogwood fruits, and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
This is WHYY.
Friends Select School, the Center City Quaker School, supports WHYY. Located on Benjamin Franklin Parkway, Philadelphia's Cultural Boulevard, Friends Select invites students in grades pre-K through 12 to experience a challenging academic program coupled with the cultural resources the city has to offer. Their next open house is Friday, November 11th. Details at friends-select.org. Friends Select School, the Center City Quaker School.
I'm Mike and Scott. Join us for the next WHYY Parenting Seminar when we'll discuss healthy nutrition for kids and families. Tuesday, November 8th at 6:30 here at WHYY. To register, visit whyy.org/member experience.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, many dogwoods produce fruits that look very appetizing in the fall. But are those fruits edible? We'll have the surprising answer in the question of the week. We'll also have lots more of your fascinating phone calls. But now it's time to welcome our guest, Sue Reed, a registered landscape architect, writer, and workshop leader. Most importantly, author of the new book, Energy Wise Landscape Design, A New Approach for Your Home and Garden. Sue, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Happy to have you here. So the name of your book is Energy Wise Landscape Design. You know, most landscape designers, I don't imagine, were taught to bring energy into the equation. When did people start becoming aware that the landscape could actually affect your energy use and your footprint on the planet?
Well, I'm glad you asked that because I'm not sure that people are aware yet. I started being aware of it a couple of years ago when I started writing the book, but I'm still trying to convince people that this is a good place to save energy because it's right out there, it's free, it's easy, and, you know, it's available to so many people, and our landscapes are full of opportunities to do this. But so far, you know, it's still a new idea for a lot of people.
So you are a registered landscape architect, which I presume means you went to school somewhere for it.
Yes, I did, and I took a fancy test to get licensed, and now I've got the name.
And where was the school? What school?
I went to the Conway School of Landscape Design, which is in Western Massachusetts. It's a pretty alternative approach to landscape architecture in that it really communicates the importance of ecological health, environmentally friendly decisions, and that's my starting point. So that's where the energy-saving piece comes in.
Now, you begin the book with what comes to mind, I would think, most frequently when people think of a planting that can save them energy. And it's something I'd like to spend some time on, if you don't mind, because I think it's dramatically misunderstood, and it is low-hanging fruit in terms of what it can do to reduce your energy costs, and that is shade trees.
Yes. I begin with that because it is the most familiar idea, the most common and widespread idea, and it is widely misunderstood, or not understood at all. But my problem with it is that so often people say you should just put a shade tree on the south side of your house, and that really is a very simplified, oversimplified advice. I think it's really important to understand where the sun is in its angle in the sky and the length of shadows that are cast by those trees, so you can actually get a much more effect. If you are investing in a shade tree on the southeast or southwest portions of a house, especially if you have any photovoltaic on the roof, you really don't want to have a shade tree on the south side of your house. Even a deciduous tree that will lose its foliage in the winter, it'll affect the efficiency of the PV. So it's not a simple recipe, as with everything in the landscape. There are, you know, lots of factors to consider. But in general, you know, a large shade tree, if you're going to plant one, should be 20, 30 feet from the southeast or southwest portion of your, away from the house.
Now, you dropped into a little bit of jargon there. We've never had anybody say PV on the show before.
Uh-oh.
And not follow it with PVC. I presume you're talking about solar panels on the roof.
Right, photovoltaic panels on the roof, exactly.
But that's going to get tricky as we get into the future. And, boy, I tell you, you and I could probably walk through the old New York World's Fair in 1940 and see a house of the future that still hasn't actually been built and lived in
yet. Well, you're right, yeah.
Now, you talk also about cooling the house by redirecting breezes. Talk about that a little bit and how that interacts with windbreaks. I'll re-explain. We talk about windbreaks all the time. I explain to our listeners who call in that a lot of plants they lose over winter that they think froze to death actually got winded to death because there was nothing to break the wind that was just desiccating these poor plants sitting out in the open. And, of course, windbreaks are a gardening farming technique that goes back many centuries. So talk about how you get some windbreaks, but maybe using the windbreaks to redirect those cooling breezes that we all long for in the summertime.
Well, there actually are two subjects. There's the winter and the summer. And in the winter, it's a windbreak. We want to deflect the wind around the house, if possible, which is very hard to do unless you have a pretty large property. But in the summer, understanding where the wind is coming from and how to encourage it to go, you know, to welcome it toward the house by perhaps pruning up the lower branches of a tree and creating what I call a window between the ground and the dense foliage above. The wind, as it squeezes through that window, will actually speed up. So, of course, it depends on where the wind is coming from. So it's not always easy or applicable in every situation, but that's one way. You don't have to have a funnel of shrubs pointing toward your house in order to take advantage of that, what's called the Venturi effect, where the wind actually speeds up a little bit. So maybe you would put your sitting space right outside there where that wind is coming through, you know, at certain times of the day. And that would expand the usefulness of your outdoor space and make it so your house doesn't need to be cooled quite as much. And, you know, it's that whole equation of just doing a little bit here and there. All adds up to the savings.
Well, I think that this is a more interesting idea than you're putting forth here, because again, in the summertime, the idea of creating kind of an area where the breezes are captured, kind of concentrated and stepping out into what would seem to be like a natural fan, would be a real mitzvah in the summertime, first of all, you know, and you can amaze your friends, right? You see, you feel the breeze over here? Well, come on here. Where? Why? You got a fan hidden? And for sitting outside, I'll point out the low-tech way to keep mosquitoes and no-see-ums and other small biting creatures away from you is to be in a slight breeze because they can't function at that level. So that may be personally more satisfying than knocking a couple of bucks off the air conditioning bill with a big tree even.
Yeah, I like what you're saying about that.
So let's talk about a typical suburban home. I know your book has the greatest value for people who are building a home or remodeling, really looking at a new landscape. But let's talk about a home that already exists that has the typical lawn and landscaping. Is there, what's the biggest mistake you make people see in not utilizing plants for this kind of benefit?
Well, let's see. I don't usually think about it in terms of a mistake, but I like to see opportunities for making a positive difference, thinking of opportunities for shade, not just shade trees that are huge, but smaller trees that might be near a house that would shade a window, and then making sure that we have as much sort of lush foliage, photosynthesizing foliage near a house, ground cover, not just lawn, but plants with foliage leaves, because all of those leaves are cooling the air through evapotranspiration. And the more we have of that near our house, I understand in the South there's concern about mold, and again, these are solutions that need to be applied with thought. But, you know, just the opportunity to keep the air around the house as cool as possible by cooling the ground, letting rain soak into the ground because that cools the ground, shading any hard surfaces like patios or driveways that are on the south side of a house, all of those things can be done to add up to cooling the air, which will then keep the house cooler and reduce that whole heat island effect that people talk about.
I mean, it's probably one of the best returns on investment you can get if you plant the right tree in the right spot.
Right. That's why I start the book with the whole discussion of shade trees, because that is going to be a big savings, especially if you're in a region of the world that's very hot in the summer.
And one thing, one thing I'm going to look at here, I want to try to set up one of your little breezeways here. I'm going to go through that section of the book real carefully and see if I can get it to work. I would love to be able to feel that effect. And I can't imagine that it can't be done pretty easily, because we're dealing with some pretty powerful forces with the right plants and nature's wind coming through. I would like to do a little bit of that harnessing. That sounds like fun.
I love the idea, and it can really work in the right place.
I'm going to try to put God's fan on my patio and chase the mosquitoes away naturally. All right, we've been talking with Sue Reed, author of Energy Wise Landscape Design, A New Approach for Your Home and Garden. The book version of the book is available from New Society Publishers. Of course, because it's an environmental tome, it's also available online as an ebook. And you can learn more about Sue's work and her book at energywiselandscape.com. Sue, thanks for being on You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
All right. And now, back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Barbara, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am doing very well. Barbara, how's yourself?
Well, good. It's raining here.
Well, it has to rain some places sometimes. I wish it hadn't rained so much on my garden this year. Where is Barbara getting wet?
We're getting wet in Downingtown, Pennsylvania.
It's making down in Downingtown. What do you expect?
It is. It's been doing it a lot.
And what can we do for Barb in Downingtown?
Every year I plant elephant ears, and I have a spot under my kitchen window that's very protected, but it's also very, very hot. It's white siding in that area. And usually the elephant ears just do beautifully. And this year with our heat in July, they really suffered, you know. But once the heat stopped and the rain came and the cool air came, these elephant ears have just flourished. And they, I measured them, and they're 3.5 feet long by 3.5 feet wide. They're bigger than I've ever seen, and they're just absolutely magnificent. People just go gaga when they see them. But, and they're about 6 feet tall, and they have a base of about 12 inches. It just kills me to see them all get frosted and die every year, but this year particularly, they're just so elegant. I've never taken the bulbs out. Every year I plant them about May, the bulbs, and then I never take them out, and I just wondered if I could preserve these somehow and replant them. I just wondered what your suggestions might be, because these are really unbelievable. I do have some black ones, but they're small, but these green ones are huge.
You know, and you don't really need them to be in a hugely sunny location. When you have a plant that is all dramatic leaf, like the elephant's ears, that's a plant that tends to do really well in shade. They evolved to have such big leaves so that they could photosynthesize in kind of a more shady environment. So I'm not surprised that they suffered a little bit if they had direct sun and reflected light coming from behind them. I'd even suggest that this is a plant you consider moving to an area where it would get some more shade and put something in there that's a real sun and light hog instead.
Mm-hmm. That's the thing that was so surprising this year, and they're still growing, actually. They're still getting bigger. This they've never been this big, and I do have some elephant ears that I planted in a pot out in a shady area. Of course, the pot probably had something to do with it, too, but they're not as big. It's just that these, they're just unbelievably huge this year.
Anytime we grow something in a container, we dictate the final size of the plant to some degree by the size of the container.
Okay.
Plants in massive containers, the same plant will get much larger than the same plant in a very small container. You take that down to its extreme, and you're in the world of bonsai.
Right.
So that's a trick for keeping plants small. Now, the elephant's ears that are in containers have to come out of the containers.
Okay.
So you got two choices here. The ones that are out there by the siding, do you want to try to overwinter them outdoors, or do you have a place inside your house where the temperature stays, say, in the 40s?
No, I don't have a basement, so it's kind of hard to find a...
Okay, here's your two options. I'll do this theoretically. First, the ones in the pots have to come out of the pots. They're not going to survive winter with their roots above ground.
Okay.
Elephant ears are semi-hardy in our environment, which means they probably would not survive winter outdoors in an open area as close to you as the Lehigh Valley, like 50 miles north.
Okay.
But in the heart of Center City, Philly, for instance, in one of these community gardens you see all through Center City, they'd probably get through winter without any kind of protection.
Oh.
So you're right in the middle there. I'm worried that it faces south so much and that it collects so much sun, because your area is going to heat up in the winter there.
Yeah.
And that's not good. We really want them to go to sleep, not get warmed or and then frozen. But if you wanted to try it, you would wait. You got to leave them out there until they turn brown.
Okay.
A light frost will, you know, shut the plants down, but it won't kill that big bulb underground. The bigger the ears you have, the more energy that bulb has collected.
Okay.
So what you would do is, after a couple of light frosts, you would cut them off, leaving about 6 inches above the soil line. Don't go down low. You don't want to injure the crowns.
Okay.
And then you would shred up a massive amount of fall leaves and put like a foot of fall leaves over top of the area that they are. Maybe like 6 inches of fall leaves, and then lay down some chicken wire to keep those leaves in place, and then cover that with more leaves.
Oh, okay.
Your option for the indoor ones is pretty much the same. You want to wait until the first light frost. Take them out of their pots, the ones that are in the pots outside, and then you want to bring them inside and literally, like, pack them up in a cardboard box with some mildly moist peat moss, not damp, not dry, with them in the center of the peat moss. Just close the box shut, and then ideally that box should be kept in a place that would be between, say, 40 and 45 degrees would be the ideal.
Okay.
And you said you don't have a basement, so that...
I could find a basement. My son lives next door. I could use his basement.
When you dig them up, try not to injure the roots at all. Better to leave a little more of this season's growth on top than less. And next year, if you plant those big ones facing north, I think we can leave them in the ground with a thick mulch over top of them.
Well, we have a wonderful time listening to your program, and I do appreciate all of your help here.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you. You take care now.
All righty. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody out there who wants to be a successful organic gardener that the time is ripe to collect and shred every fall leaf you can find. Once shredded, those leaves become the essential ingredient of compost making and the perfect mulch to apply now or in the spring. And shredded they must be, because dropping leaves down on the ground whole is how big trees smother small plants. And lawns, hint, hint. But don't you go mulching that maple mess into your turf just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and a straight answer on the edibility of dogwood fruits. I'm Edible Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You're listening to WHYY. It's 11:38, 46 degrees in Center City.
Mike McGrath, right back at you with local events. It will once again be my honor to host the annual Empty Bowl Benefit Dinner for the Homeless at Chestnut Hill College on the evening of Thursday, November 17th. You get to pick out a beautiful handmade bowl to take home, enjoy delicious soups donated by area restaurants, and ask me your garden questions live and in person. Then on Saturday evening, November 19th, I'll deliver the keynote address and answer all your garden questions at the opening of Companion Plant in Kutztown, PA. A new enterprise devoted to indoor and outdoor gardening, food preservation, and sustainable living. We'll post all the details at the events section of our website, youbetyourgarden.org.
The WHYY forecast, mostly sunny today, high temperature about 54. Tonight, clear, the low 33. Sunday, mostly sunny with a high of 58. The work week starts off beautifully. Monday, sunshine, high of 62. Tuesday, sunny with a high of 66. And Wednesday, mostly sunny, high 64. Thursday, some showers should move in.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll be getting to a very interesting question of the week, one that I really enjoyed researching and did not know the answer before I started calling around. Can you eat those interesting-looking fruits that form on dogwoods in the fall? We'll have the authoritative, definitive, almost, answer when we get to the question of the week, right after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Michael, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Michael. How are you?
I'm doing great.
And where are you doing great, sir?
I'm doing great in historic Lewis, Delaware.
Okay, certainly not Lewis, Delaware.
No, not at all.
All right, what can we do for Michael and Lewis?
Well, I have been growing habanero peppers for some time. I usually eat one habanero a day, if not two. I really enjoy the smoky taste and the really good peppers.
And you can eat them raw.
In a sandwich or in a salad.
And just bite into them.
Oh, they're great. They taste great. The problem I have, and this sounds strange, but there are critters boring holes into my habaneros and actually eating them. I've had a number of habaneros eaten, and I don't know what kind of hardy insect would be that bold to eat habanero peppers.
And it is a circular little round hole.
Yes, absolutely right.
That would be the pepper weevil.
Okay.
We don't discuss weevils a lot on the show. The couple times we do, they tend to crop up as pests of stored grain and grain-like objects. The bean weevil is a notorious pest for people who grow beans for drying for winter use. And in that case, the problem is easily solved. You just freeze the beans for like a day and it kills the weevils. And you get a little extra protein.
Right.
You know, but that's, hey, you were eating the beans for the protein anyway. I have to be honest and say that I've not really experienced the pepper weevil going for the really hot peppers. They tend to be more of a pest of bell peppers.
Okay.
But
well,
if you
I
just
have jalapenos and they didn't bother them, and I have an Italian pepper whose name I don't remember right now, but it's an heirloom pepper, and they didn't bother that. They just hit the habaneros.
And these holes are very distinctive. There's not a lot of them. Typically, there's just one or two holes per pepper, and then some part of the inside of the pepper starts to be eaten, and it turns brown, and it's unattractive.
It may enlarge the hole. A couple of them have had the holes look like they were a little bit bigger than a round bullet hole.
Because birds...
They were obviously eaten, and I've never seen the insect. You know, I've opened the pepper and there's nothing in there.
I have found them to be an occasional pest. They show up once every, like, 5-6 years.
Yeah.
Then they're gone for a while. Then they come back again. In the future, you have two choices. Obviously, first, walk your peppers every day. Take a good look at them. And if you see any with holes in them, just take them right off the plant, take them inside, cut them up, and use them. Because, you know, you can use peppers at any stage, even
right.
though, you know, the green ones don't have the full flavor. Sometimes with hot peppers, it's good to mix up the different color levels, especially
okay.
the peppers that go through multiple color changes. If it gets really annoying, you can spray the fruits with either neem, N-E-E-M,
okay.
or one of the spinosads. Those are organic insecticides, no threat to humans or other wildlife, but deadly to any insects who bite into the sprayed fruit.
Oh, good.
So okay. that would be a safe way. Otherwise, you'd have to drape them with row covers, but it might be difficult to get the covers tight enough to keep a weevil out.
So
I wouldn't do anything immediately. But at the site of the first hole, I would pull that pepper off. You know, that's also going to make another pepper produce much more quickly. And then I would be ready with either neem or a spinosad to spray on the rest of them, and everybody goes home early.
Good. Okay, yeah, because I don't like to use anything on plants that I grow. I mean, the only thing I've ever used is seven dust on eggplants to stop those little lace bugs. But I do that so early in the season that and I don't use
that
any
is-
chemicals.
Seven is one of the most toxic substances available for homeowners to use. I would really suggest you ixnay that,
okay.
and it's going to be taken off the market soon anyway.
Oh,
it's just too toxic. Now you have a reason to have the neem or spinosads in hand. You're going to use them early in the season against what I'm guessing is flea beetles on your eggplant.
Yes. Okay. So the neem would work even on the eggplants then?
It will work on any plant and deter any insect that's trying to chew on the plant.
Oh,
but,
wonderful.
But the extra bonus here is a butterfly could land on the plant, because the butterfly doesn't eat, it flies away unharmed.
Okay, good.
So very safe. The seven is not safe for you. Don't be using that no more.
Okay.
All right, Michael?
Thank you so much. I
Take
appreciate
care.
It.
All right. 1-888-346-9499. Clayton, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello there.
Hello, Clayton. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. Yourself?
I am doing very well today, thank you. Where is Clayton doing well?
Here in central Indiana.
Okay, very good. What can we do for you, sir?
Well, I have a bargain bin variety of asparagus that I purchased this spring. I'm a new gardener, and I put it out this year. It came up very well, and here at the end of the year, I don't know. Do I need to cut it back or anything, or just let it fall over and clean up?
So you didn't do anything. You just let the spears come up, and you left them alone, and you watched it. Very good.
Yep, I let it go to seed the first year. I did learn that. But I just don't know what to do here for the fall for it.
Now, when you say go to seed, did your asparagus actually produce seed, or do you mean you just let it grow into those gigantic fronds?
Both. It actually, there were six different root systems.
Roots, yeah, crowns.
They're in the end of the fronds, but it looks like they're seeds.
Some older varieties of asparagus do produce seed. The modern hybrid varieties that a lot of people prefer do not. There's nothing wrong with the seeded varieties. It's just that the hybrids send all of their energy into doing more spears for you. And the ones that go to seed, they save some of their energy for that, so you don't get as big a harvest. No, you've done everything right so far.
Okay. Well, I do have one other question. I've heard what I think is possibly a wise tale, but was told that you can take water and dilute salt in it and pour around your asparagus, that the asparagus actually does better with it, and then the salinity of the soil will keep weeds down.
Yes, rock salt for asparagus is a very old technique, makes no sense to me, but apparently it does work. It doesn't hurt the asparagus, and it does limit the number of weeds. I will tell you, I don't have a lot of personal experience here. I don't grow asparagus. I have a certain amount of room, and my big perennial crop is raspberries, and they're real space hogs. So I'd want you to go online and just investigate the timing of when that should be done. But I'll tell you, you've done everything well so far. You leave those fronds standing. If you like, when we get to, you know, like the middle of winter, say right after Christmas, you can go out and cut them down, but leave them there. Leave them there as mulch and insulation. In the spring, I then want you to look and watch for the new spears to come up. At that point, you should cut and remove any old fronds that are still standing. Let the new spears begin to come up. And the book says in your second year you shouldn't harvest any. But to tell you the truth, I think that's waiting too long. You can harvest literally just a couple of spears from the first round, especially if the spears that are coming up look nice and thick. If you don't get anything come up in the spring that is bigger than a pencil, just take one or two spears. But if you've got some good fat spears coming up, you can harvest the first couple, but then stop when the new spears coming up are not as fat as a pencil anymore, and let those spears do the same thing. They collect solar energy, and they feed the crown underneath the soil with solar energy. They create those big fronds. The fronds, you know, they look like solar panels. That's their job. And then the third year, you can really begin harvesting a good amount of asparagus. Every spring, you want to stop when the new run of spears that's coming up is smaller than a pencil. So that's real easy to remember. And they love to be fed. Well-composted horse manure is one of their favorite foods. Just be sure it's not fresh. It can't be any smell to it, can't be any heat to it, because if it's not fully composted, you'll get weeds out of it.
Oh, okay.
And weeds are the biggest enemy of an asparagus grower. Okay?
Well, thank you very much.
All right, my pleasure. Enjoy your spears next spring, even if it's just one or two.
I will, thank you.
Take care, man. All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Does the dogwood bear bitter fruit or tasty fruit? We get started with an email from Gemma in Frederick, Maryland, who writes, "My 7-year-old wants to eat the fruit of our dogwood trees. They look a little bit like big cherries or light red and have dots all over. He told me he heard they were edible. I think he tried them already and is now asking for, quote, permission because I caught him getting ready to eat one. Are they edible?" Evelyn in central New Jersey writes, we planted a dogwood tree in the front yard about 5 or 6 years ago, and this is the first year I've seen fruit on it. The bright red berries grow in clumps, and I've read that they might be edible. Is this true? If so, what can I expect them to taste like? Can I use them in muffins and pancakes? Well, there are many different types of dogwoods, some of which bear fruit that's, quote, edible, meaning you won't get sick after you eat it, and some whose edible fruits are so tasty they're a sought-after delight. The botanical moniker of the dogwood most renowned for its fruit is Cornus moss, better known by the common name of Cornelian cherry. Its fruit is praised by the likes of wild food expert Steve Wildman Brill and rare fruit expert Dr. Lee Reich, who once caused a conniption by picking and eating some of the fruits off a tree in New York's Central Park. As related in the Cornelian cherry chapter of his classic book, Uncommon Fruits for Every Garden, Lee explained to the concerned passersby that he was enjoying a delicacy that we humans have been eating for over 7,000 years, with both archaeology and ancient writings serving as evidence that early Greeks and Romans gathered and savored the, quote, cherries. Lee recounts that the great British herbalist Gerard sang its praises as a, quote, cherry in 1597, and that the plant was actively grown for its fruits, sometimes called Cornell plums, in the 1700s. He adds that the species is still very popular as a fruit tree in its native Western Asia and Eastern Europe, where many homes have a tree or two in their gardens or orchards, and the ripe fruits are a common sight in local markets at harvest time. It's also a very ornamental tree, explains Lee, who made it one of the top 40 plants in his newest book, Landscaping with Fruit. The blooms are great, he explains, and they last for a month. Mature trees produce fruit almost every year, and the trees are very long-lived, despite topping out at a landscape-friendly 25 feet. He describes the fruits as oval, cherry-like, and fire engine red with a single stone inside, and likens their taste to that of sour cherries. He once served a big batch of ripe ones to the attendees at a NOFA conference, that's the Northeast Organic Farmers Association, and relates that 60% of the people who tried them thought they were too tart to eat by themselves, that they'd have to be used in a recipe with sugar or other added sweeteners. But 40% of the crowd loved them just as they were, pronouncing the fruits sweet enough to eat out of hand. Lee describes the leaves of the Cornelian cherry dogwood as a satiny green in the summer, often but not always turning mahogany red in the fall. The small yellow flowers are among the earliest of spring bloomers to appear, he notes, opening up well before those of Forsythia. While most of the fruits are red, some named varieties bear fruit that is white or yellow when ripe. And in the wild, where the trees have cross-pollinated for perhaps millennia, Lee notes that the range of fruit colors and shapes can seem almost endless. He's seen fruits in the shapes of barrels and pears and colors ranging from creamy to almost black. On average, he notes, the fruits have twice as much vitamin C as the same weight of oranges, and one mature tree can produce 30 to 50 pounds of fruit a season. In his excellent wild vegetarian cookbook, noted forager Steve Wildman Brill offers several recipes for what he describes as the national fruit of Turkey, including a homemade version of the Cornelian cherry soda you'll find for sale in parts of Europe and Asia, an animal-free gelatin-like dessert, and of course a Cornelian cherry pastry. Lee Reich adds that he has also sampled the fruits of the Cusa dogwood, Cornus cusa, another common landscape ornamental originally from Asia. Those fruits are weird, he explains. They look like little landmines and have an unusual texture, but they're also very sweet and not at all sour. Other sources describe the fruits as looking more like raspberries, or perhaps the business end of a flail or a mace. Anyway, they're round, bumpy, and distinctly different from the other types under discussion here. And what about the fruits of the also very common in the landscape Native American flowering dogwood, Cornus florida? The USA National Phrenology Network at the University of Arizona warns that the fruits are edible by birds and other wildlife, but toxic to humans. Ah, but an entry at Wikipedia says that they're edible and that they're used to sweeten tea in Mexico. And our good friend Dr. Jim Duke, retired USDA researcher, expert on the medicinal properties of plants, and author of the renowned Green Pharmacy series of books, says that he has actually sampled the fruits of his flowering dogwoods and suffered no ill effects. But he also does not recommend them. They tasted terrible, he told me. Well, that sure was an interesting look at the wide world of dogwood fruit now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, this and every question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To carefully review the important information in this week's Wonder, just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes! My producer is threatening to feed me funny fruits if I don't get out of this studio. Huh, wait a minute. You know, those look more like deadly nightshade berries than Hey, we must be out of time, but you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please, please, please tell us where you live. Please put the actual subject in the subject line, and please check first to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week. Find the solution to hundreds of garden problems. Hint, hint, take a hint just like yours in our Garden Answers A to Z section. And or listen to this show, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Lunas, executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Fearless Fred Snyder. Our webmasters are Baneful Rich Banowitz and Sarah the She-Devil Kazar. Blooming Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Charific Julia Worski is our production assistant. Inedible Al Banks is our editor. I'm Doggy Mike McGrath, and I'll see you next week. Many people love to grow in containers, but what do you do with your potted plants over winter? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll review the basics of keeping potted plants alive until spring, plus your fabulous phone calls.
Mike's grandiloquent Gab Fest offers gratifyingly gameful glimpses into growing groovy grass, goldenrod, gloxinia, and more. Join Mike Saturday mornings at 11 here on WHYY.